From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Sebastian Knowles is a professor of English and the Associate Dean for Faculty and Research in the Colleges of Arts and Humanities at Ohio State. He is a James Joyce scholar with four single or co-authored books on Joyce and counting, and he joins us today to talk about his interest in writing, academic writing, and recovering one's past through writing. Welcome, Professor Knowles.
Thank you.
Okay. So tell me, you've got a book, The Dublin Helix, The Life and Language, Life of Language in Joyce's Ulysses, and you write in there that the use of a large letter S in an early edition of a Joyce text led you to read it.
Right.
But I'm assuming there's more to it than that. Tell me about your interest in Joyce. Was it just having that large letter S?
If it had been any other initial, I think my course of my career would have been totally different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Imagine if you had seen a large D with your initials DD, you would have been immediately attracted to it.
Right. Actually, in some of my classes in college, I did see large Ds, and that led me to go into other fields. But
the S for me was a serpent. It was a kind of an invitation, as it were, the serpent of knowledge in the garden. And it was a large, sinuous as well, black, huge, page-filling icon. Okay. And it was the first initial of my name. And I thought, I'm about 9 at this point. Cool.
And you're reading Joyce at 9?
No, I'm taking it from my grandfather's bookshelf, because he had lots of really cool old books, which all turn out to be modernist books, because he collected them. This is modernism, 1900 and 1940. And there wasn't a lot to do in a village next to a duck pond in England where I grew up. There was certainly no television. I think the telephone had 4 digits, which is, in fact, my PIN code. So don't look up the 1961. I won't tell you what village it is.
Right. Oh, darn.
But having nothing to do, it appeared to me that what I should do is look for interesting things in books. And this S just jumped at me. And it really was that simple. Later on, though, I have to admit, at 9, I put it away. I think I was about 16. Somebody told me that Ulysses was a dirty book. Like most 16-year-olds, I was now in America at this time. I thought, well, let's give it a try.
You're making a stronger and stronger case for your interest in Joyce.
And for the literary study generally.
Right. You
know, it's all a set of happy accidents.
Okay.
I never did find any dirty words, but there were some astonishing headlines and typographical conceits and a whole set of, you know, from the end of Ulysses, a set of texts without punctuation that alarmed me and intrigued me. And I thought, I've got to look into this more closely.
Okay. So when you started looking into Joyce more closely and you, I think, is that the subject of your dissertation?
No, actually, I have to say, Joyce came late. I was a late bloomer. My dissertation was on the Second World War because of circumstances related to my upbringing in England, that I, you know, my father, who had been a boy during the war, would only take me on holidays to see Spitfires in the Imperial War Museum. And so I sort of bonded with this war story that he had and that his father had, and he would always tell stories of his father, who was an air raid warden. Just out of habit and thinking that that would be an interesting thing to do, I wrote a connection between the literature and the history of the Blitz, of London at the time. And that was at Princeton, and it wasn't really until I came here at Ohio State that I became a Joycean.
Okay. When you say you wrote the connection, because at the beginning of this you quote, is it T.S. Eliot's Only Connect? Was that Eliot?
E.M. Forster.
E.M. Right. I was close.
It was initials. Right there. The two initials, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a modernist, so I get away with it. Does that get me away with it? No?
It's good.
Okay, good enough. So tell me, when you got interested in Joyce and interested in modernism, tell me a little bit about your take on modernism. The next question is going to be, now we're not in the modernist era, right?
Right.
We're in postmodernism or post-postmodernism or some, you
contemporary.
Know,
it's a huge zoo of contemporary literature.
Which is another thing that in another 40 years will mean nothing, in much in the way that it'll be one of these art labels like modernism that, of course, you eventually move out of that and then you're left with this label to say, I don't know what this means. But so tell me about modernism and your attraction to it.
I have to go back again. It's the books that, again, my parents were reading by their bedside table. Mm-hmm. Modernism, for me, was just a collection of detective stories, Dorothy Sayers, The Nine Tailors, books by obscure British writers who are actually poets, I didn't know this later. Mm-hmm. I later found out that C. Day Lewis, the great friend of W. H. Auden, has another one with C. S.
Right, right, and another
There's
initials that
C.S.
I'll
C.S. Lewis.
Screw
They're
up later. Good. Looking forward to it.
He also wrote detective novels under Blake, Nicholas Blake, very clever ones. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading these quasi-literary. Michael Innes was another one. He was a critic, J.I.M. Stewart. We all have, I'm S.D.G. Knowles. In England, initials are very, very important.
Why is that?
It's partly why I was so drawn to Ulysses. It's just a thing. We like to hide our real names. You find that out later, who I really am. But the whole impulse for me studying modernism was really, these were books, paperbacks, lying around the house that looked interesting, and they weren't like Milton and large sonnet sequences by obscure friends of Shakespeare's colleagues. And it struck me as they had nice covers and they were really fun to read, that I would just breeze through them. And I said, if I can study this, then it won't hurt so much.
Okay.
Because the key to writing is to not allow it to hurt.
All right. Well, I'll come back to that
one,
the not allowing the hurt, because that seems out of step with a lot of garroted poets who are very much interested in hurting so that they can write. But so tell me, what does a modernist artist or author like Joyce
You said it.
Have to say?
You already said it. They're connectors. They're the people who are trying to put together a globe, a time, a civilization that's fallen apart. And I'm not just referring to the shrapnel of World War I. It's quite clear that if you are Picasso or Joyce or Eliot or even Forster, who wrote Howard's End, of course, before the war, you're responding to a split in the psyche that Freud has established, dividing psychoanalysis into ego, id, and superego. Niels Bohr has split the atom. Wherever you look, people are dividing, fragmenting, consciousness is time is being layered and broken by people like Bergson, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913 for his creative evolution. It's not just the war, but wherever you look, things are falling apart. Class, Marx, wherever you look, it's there. And of course, Cubism isn't clearly a response to this. And so is The Wasteland, and so is Joyce. And what I've discovered is that you can say that they're all bad boys saying, look, it's all fallen apart, this world of chaos. But actually, there's a joy in ordering chaos. I've discovered this as an administrator, that I think there's a reason that Joyceans go into admin a lot, because they're familiar with chaos, they know about chaos, but they revel in ways, either unanticipated patterns of order, like fractals, or in ways of just making it more simple. Because you have something so complex, your job as an artist is to simplify.
Okay. And contrast that against, say, postmodernism, which seems to revel in the disorder. You've got, in contrast to Joyce, The Simpsons.
Right. Or Pynchon would be possibly a better example. But it's true that, yes, we descend into layers of parody and
descended.
Pastiche. Yes, did descended. I say descend?
Just descended. No.
You'll find that Shakespeareans are sort of very protective of their field, and modernists too. We're attacked on both flanks. The Victorians like to co-opt us and say we were really very prudish Victorian types, which is actually true, reactionaries rather than revolutionaries. And the postmodernists like to come down and say that people like Joyce were just anticipations of Borges. But we'd like to keep the parameters very clear.
Right.
Okay. 1890 to 1945. Okay. Everybody else, go away.
Okay. So how do you, when you're teaching, make that relevant? How do you make those connections only connect with the students with Joyce and these, what I think of as very difficult? I did not breeze through any of these. I like punctuation. That's why I'm in rhetoric and composition.
If you love punctuation, you've got to read Finnegan's Wake. It's one of the classic punctuation-free texts. I just wrote something that I'm so proud of this. My kids' coloring book, the page from the kids' coloring book, made it to the front cover of the Journal of Record in my field because I just wrote an article called Finnegan's Wake for Dummies.
Okay.
And it's probably trademarked, but I had to use it.
Right, yeah.
And the kids' coloring book is the Book of Kells, the Irish great monastic text. And it was colored by my graduate students the first day. I just passed it around and said, this is crucial for Finnegan's Wake. You guys, we got nothing really to say about Finnegan's Wake because I haven't read it yet. Why don't we just color this in? And they colored it beautifully. And it was an illustration of how anybody can get into the text, because this page was actually very important. It's a crucifixion but very, very embellished. So there's death behind it, like as in Finnegan's Wake. But it's a very embellished kind of death, the way the text, Finnegan's Wake, is a very embellished sort of death of literature. And as they're illustrating it, it became clear that that was the way in, that if we could start with what was easiest and work, as it were, in a ski slope method with the bunny slope, the green dots,
right,
and then you fundle up and go down and, right, and they applaud, and then you go to the blue squares and then you risk your neck on the black diamonds. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, how you have to teach. You have to start. And Joyce is completely unhelpful with this. If you think of Dubliners, the first story is Sisters. Nobody can understand it. Portrait of the Artist, just minefield after minefield. Ulysses begins with the Telemachus period. Stephen Dedalus again. Hard to read. Finnegan's Wake 2 begins badly. And he's doing it on purpose. He's making a paradox. He's saying you can only read this text if you have already read it. Mm-hmm. So what we have
you
to do...
You can only read it if you're rereading it.
Right.
It makes sense
it
when you're rereading
it. It is impossible to read it first time. And given that, and that's true of most hermetic texts like The Wasteland and think of Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, there are many examples of texts which forbid the reader access. And so our trick is to try and find ways in.
Okay. Well, you're a musician and the editor of Bronze by Gold, The Music of Joyce.
Right.
I'm curious, tell me about the overlap that you see with music and literature. It's something that I'm personally interested in and I'd like your review on it.
Well, I just was talking to Jim Piner, who's a professor of clarinet here, and he wanted to get some advice on language and music too. He was interested in the sound of speech and the sound of the clarinet pitch. Technically, you can get extremely technical with the science of it. And I sent him some things from Bronze by Gold that I'd written about music and language and about the innate rhythms of speech and how when you know you're writing well, it's because you can hear the beats in your texts as you go. That
you don't mean meter, you just mean there's something outside that, that you're feeling the beats in it.
The End of the Dead is famous, of course. Gabriel Conroy has been jilted in the past by his wife. He discovers it, and his soul swoons softly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of our last end upon all the living and the dead. And there are beats in that. Faintly falling, falling faintly through the universe on all the living and the dead. If you're writing well, and Joyce, God knows, knew how to write well, and he sort of says, I got this one, you know, watch this. It's a virtuoso effect, mm-hmm, but it's all, the words are very simple. His soul swoons softly, but you only have to hear it loud to get this S going as you feel him with the snow. The cadence is so perfect that it's like a composed piece. And I think I teach a class on music and literature, or used to, where we would put your friend E.M. Forster again. Howard's End has a wonderful chapter where they go to hear Beethoven's Fifth and everybody's sort of wondering what it means, and somebody's reading the score and somebody's watching the cat on the balustrade and somebody's enraptured with it and sees goblins and elephants. And the point is that music is like the best of literature, is a text that cannot be known fully and has to be sort of perceived from different subjective angles. And I find that to be a very compelling a way to teach because it empowers the student, mm-hmm, ninefold.
Okay. Well, in 2000, you won the Arts and Sciences Outstanding Teaching Award and the English Graduate Professor of the Year.
I had no idea this was going to happen.
I'm surprised that you didn't know that. Couple years ago.
I did know that, but I thought you were going to ask me about writing, and now you're sending me up as a teacher.
I'm sorry for that. I shouldn't have done that.
I love teaching.
Well, how do you get students interested in writing?
Right.
You said you bring the reading of the texts, you bring it in the easy way, but what's your take on getting them to write and write well? This is, after all, writer's talk.
Right. It's true, but it's not connected. It's funny.
That's not connected.
The pain that I have as a writer, I've never been able to transfer, or I never really revealed to any student. I've said, oh, it's fine, just work on this draft. Here's another draft. Just going along, here's a third one. Mm-hmm. You'll get it. And some writers, some students are just born writers. They write like angels. And some work very hard. And some write so beautifully that I'm sure they plagiarized, but it turns out they've actually, you know, got the gift. Mm-hmm. And the gift is something to do with language and something to do with music. But it's a lot to do with pain. And I don't try to communicate how difficult writing is to my students because I fear that I'm maybe one of few people who find it really, really, really hard.
I don't think that that's true. I think that most people, many people, find it hard, or we wouldn't be working so hard to teach it.
In the academic world, we're all, you know, writing books, and what are you working on is the phrase that people say, oh, yes, I'm breezily working on it, as if, you know, oh, you know, what's your cat, or how's the leaves piling up? What are you working on is like saying, how much blood did you get out of the stone, you know, last week, or have you managed to spark flint yet, you know, in the back of your, in your backyard? And I really think writing is an incredibly scarring process. And it sounds like I'm sort of this defeated person who can't, you know, write his way out of a paper bag. But it's because it's so bloody hard, and I'm going to swear in front of your television or radio audience, so bloody hard, that when I teach writing, it's mostly, here's a very good example from Dickens. We always do a Dickens novel. Here's a poet, it's usually somebody like Dickinson or Elizabeth Bishop, who there's some usually a connection to. We always have to do a Shakespeare play, and I try and having taught this writing class so many times, we got sort of things like Coriolanus and Cymbeline, you know, because we're running out of, because I could keep it fresh for myself. Why are we doing this one? Well, you know, this is my 12th time, I've got to do a new one. And a Hardy novel or something like that. And so, but the best has been thought and said in various genres. Some wonderful essays, Nicolae Codrescu, who has some wonderful essays in A Craving for Swan. If I find some good nonfiction essays, I'll throw them in. So different genres, different styles, give them time.
And say, here's the model.
Yeah.
And I want you to write like Dickens.
Sure. Or no, I want you to be a critical writer, because that's what we're teaching. Mm-hmm. A critical writer of Dickens, or of novels, or of essays, or of poetry, mm-hmm. or of plays. I don't teach creative writing. And if I did, people would leave after the first 10 minutes, because my advice would be so strange that they would be sure I was mad.
Well, let's go to an essay that right. you've written, and perhaps you can read some of that if you'd like. Birkenau, The Place Where Irony Goes to Die.
Right.
It's part travelogue, part personal history, part exploration of a lot of the themes that I think that you're interested in, World War II, the experience there, your personal experience. But it's quite different from what I think of as academic writing. Mm-hmm. Tell me about writing it. You wrote it at Birkenau.
It's true. Having said that writing is impossible, there was one time in my life when it came easily. Mm-hmm. And that is that way. You put your finger on it, which is going to make me seem like a fraud. Okay. Because that was an easy time.
Well, there's always going to be, I think there are easy things.
Right.
Because the emotions that you're writing about are can come out. I mean, I've done that. But I'm interested in, and this is one of the things you gave me to set up the interview. Right. And so I'm curious
about
the writing of it.
Exactly. But I'm not willing to give it to you yet. I will. The Birkenau is a piece that came out of a curious, sort of annoyingly ironic state of mind that I have always in the back of my head. I think modernists are always acutely attuned to irony. And I was finding things that were wrong with the picture as I went to Auschwitz. And the fact that there was a truck stop advertised right next to the Museum of Auschwitz, which had an iconic silhouette of a shower, saying, you know, truck stop showers, Bremse, Brausen, only 3 miles, 3 kilometers. And it was the white silhouette of a man having a shower under on a blue card. And I thought, that seems tactless, thoughtless, stupid, in fact. And then we went into the area where, as you're processed as a visitor, you're very much processed in the same space where inmates were processed and separated into languages for tours and not permitted to go on your own. And there was a sort of a sense of bewilderment, and I felt deeply troubled by the way that the experience was arranged for me and presented. And so it took me a long, hot walk, the 3 miles over the railway bridges to Birkenau, where nobody was, to escape the tour buses and the people looking for cafeterias and the people saying, well, we've only got 2 hours, we can't afford a 4 hour tour. You know, I thought, well, I think you can probably afford 4 hours. I've got to get back to Krakow for the restaurant, you know. And so I needed to see it solitary, and I went off to Birkenau, where nobody was there. It's 400 acres of the other Auschwitz camp, and wandered around the dead ponds where the the ashes were thrown in, and I found a sort of peaceful but totally quiet. There are no birds, there's no only sound of frogs in the ponds. I found a ring of benches, again, totally abandoned for tour groups that hadn't made it. And I just pulled out a pad of paper and wrote. And then I realized that's what writing should be. All my previous writing as an academic in libraries, hidden away, writing about Joyce or writing about the Second World War, never really writing about myself, never really approaching my own truth, but always hesitantly presenting the truth that others have said and that I'd admired, that it just came out. So here's what it is, and this was hard to write. I just read a paragraph. I sit down at a parallel corner on the other side of the camp and write all this down in a clump of trees where someone has thoughtfully put 20 benches in a circle, except that there's nobody here. There hasn't been anybody here for 30 minutes. I'm 2 hours away from where I started. I must set off for Budapest soon, but there's no leaving this place unrecorded. Birds sing in the trees, wasps buzz, toads croak in the ponds. But this is the deadest place on earth. I told you there were no birds. There are birds, but somehow they make it seem even more dead. The museum in Canada, which takes you, which is Canada, is of course, Canada and Mexico were the names that the inmates called the spaces, which takes you through the process by which incoming prisoners chosen for survival were dehumanized, has at the end a heartbreaking display of the living, donated by relatives after the war. A pre-war paradise on wall after wall after wall. Wedding photos, naked boys on rugs, two girls out for a walk, all dead. Birkenau doesn't play any games. It is evil. It is the one thing that will be left when our civilization has ended. Our Roman Forum, our Herculaneum, designed by a political movement with a genius for symmetry, operated by a country with a genius for efficiency, created by a species with a genius for hate, and all in my beautiful Poland, a defenseless country of open fields. I've discovered at the same time that I was Polish, that my ancestors were Jewish and came from a shtetl in 1880, so that's part of a coming together. But you see in the rhythms of that, a genius for hate, a genius for efficiency, a genius for symmetry, referring to the Nazi party there, that I think that's the power of effective writing. If it has music, if it has balance. Samuel Johnson was famous for the balance of his writings, and you can just write them, scan them out like mobiles. They balance perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I think when you're writing well, you know. It's funny. I'm going to say this anyway. I said I would to myself. Writing is so bloody hard that you have to be completely distraction-free. You have to be in a foreign library that has no texts that can distract you of any kind. The windows are deadly. You can't have a window. It has to be the Divinity School Library, or for me, it's the East Asian Library, where everything is in Chinese or Japanese, and so I can't sort of, even reading the newspaper, I only get a photograph. I have to go back to my work. So writing is what happens when there's nothing else to distract you, and you wait, and maybe the desire will finally hit you after an hour and a half. You say, okay, maybe I will pick up a pen, and maybe I will have to do something. I've been sitting here for 90 minutes. And you finally write something, and the way you know it's working is sometimes, it doesn't happen often, but a trickle of sweat will run down your upper arm. And I thought, ugh. And what was that? How did that happen? Mm-hmm. Is it hot in here? What's the matter with me? Am I sad about something? Is that a tear? No, it was a physical response to good writing. It was my body telling me that worked. It's only happened 3 or 4 times in my non sort of creative career. Mm-hmm. And I remember the sentences where I said, yeah, I got that one, right? But in Birkenau, writing in this field, I was weeping sweat. It was an extraordinary experience.
Okay. So, and it comes back to me, it sounds very much like your description of at the beginning when you were talking about doing the reading.
Right.
There's nothing else to do. There's no television. There's right. no telephone.
Yeah, that's right.
You all
right.
come back to this centering experience, mm-hmm. which is possibly one of the most difficult things to get, say, students to come to, because modern life is distractions.
Right.
So
this is it. I mean, I think if I had any advice for writers, it would be to find a secret library, find a secret space where nobody could bother you. Mm-hmm. Go to a place where you don't know anyone.
A room of one's own.
I have one. It's a secret. I could tell you, but there's one library. You have to find a library in your campus that nobody you know goes there, that everything is in a foreign language. I'll give it away because I'm not. Geography is perfect for me. It's maps, people of, you know, stratifications of county, Ohio counties. The Orton Hall Library. Mm-hmm. It's all geology, geography. Go upstairs, there's a musician's gallery with some old oak tables. Nobody ever bother you there. Okay. And you need a place where there's nothing to do. So when you get up and walk around, you think, there's really nothing to do here. I better sit with my books. And maybe there are people who just do it, you know, who have big ideas and they rattle it off and they get their index cards and they write a book. And, you know, Humphrey Carpenter writes a biography a year. He's unfortunately deceased. But there are others who just, you know, write and write and write in my faculty. But for me, it's a slow, labor-intensive process. And what you're saying about students with their technological distractions, it can be an asset. You can find a place just with headphones and you could probably type on an iPhone, but on a small notebook. I think it's easier now than it ever was to get away. Mm-hmm. And so.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Knowles, for coming. Dean Knowles, for coming here.
Associate Dean. My son calls me the helper dean.
Helper Dean Knowles. Right. for coming here and talking to us about writing today. And from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.